Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station.
Hello and welcome to Pearl on Politics. The second Saturday of each month, Professor David Pearl will host his show, Pearl on Politics. Hello, Professor Pearl.
Hello, Pamela. Well, this is Pearl on Politics. I am your host, Dr. David Pearl. I'm joined in the studio today by Pamela Spotto and Craig Boyer. Our engineer, Shane Houchins, is out today, so we will see if we can get the technical side of the house under control. And welcome, Pamela and Craig.
You too.
Hello, David.
Hey. So today I wanted to discuss the so-called Cal exit. And for those of you unfamiliar, Cal exit is a term that stands for the secession of California from the United States of America. But I didn't want to begin overtly in the terminology. Instead, I wanted to look at the not-so-distant future in a world of fiction. In this work of fiction, California is occupied by a malignant and fascist force. Body armor-clad soldiers scour the state, enforcing subjective order and searching for undocumented persons to detain, deport, and worse. In this fantasy, a growing violent resistance to this occupation has cropped up. This is, of course, a fiction, but a fiction put out by a group that is heavily promoting the Cal Exit movement. This is a comic book series put out by a fellow by the last name of Campbell, Boss, Newham, and Piazzlo, and heavily promoted by the Yes California campaign. Now, before we discuss this comic, I want to talk about something that occurred a few days ago. And it occurred on Fox News, of all places, on a late-night television show called Tucker Carlson Tonight. On this show, which is hosted by the conservative pundit Tucker Carlson, he hosted the self-proclaimed leader of this Cal exit movement, a fellow by the name of Shankar Singham. Mr. Singham was asked about his movement, and he boldly proclaimed that currently California is its own country, that we do things differently here in California, and that even if federal law proclaims any activity that we deem necessary illegal, that we would violate that law. Mr. Singham went on to agree with a conservative host who made the bold and rather, incorrect claim that California's, quote, middle class were fleeing the state, end quote. Now, California has a net gain each year across all income levels, you know, from the working poor, from folks who are undocumented working in the fields, to the high-tech sector, to folks who are everywhere in between. So for Mr. Singham to tacitly agree that we are losing middle class to Texas and to Oregon and to who knows where was an admission from his complete space of ignorance. In fact, California is growing. He was correct in saying that we are the fifth largest economy in the world if you separate our economy and our gross domestic product from that of the rest of the continental United States. He was incorrect in his assertion that we are a separate country. And we are all Americans, after all. Now, there's a caveat here, because we are citizens of the United States until the point that we aren't. And what the Cal exit movement broadly proclaims is that through the power of the 10th Amendment, every state has the right to secede from that union upon popular referendum. for those of you unfamiliar with the 10th Amendment. It broadly states that powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The interpretation the CalExit movement has is that because there is no power enumerated to the federal government that states who may secede and who may stay, that that power is reserved to the people of each individual state. Now, there are all kinds of separate arguments to this. You could say, well, if it is okay for California in the modern era, why wasn't it okay for the Confederate States of America in the late 1800s? And there, too, the CalExit movement has a broad answer. They say, look, there was a substantive evil, the evil of slavery, that caused the attack on the Southern Confederate States. Now, I don't know if I buy that. I think that this was a slavery was the major issue, of course, for the South. This is why they seceded from the Union. I'm not sure that the Northern states went to war necessarily over slavery, but rather expanding the power of wealthy individuals in the North. Whatever the case may be, it's clear that the South seceded, and it's clear that they were stopped with a violent, they were stopped with coercion, with violence. Where the CalExit movement ceases to become a legitimate movement and stretches into that realm occupied at one time only by the Confederate States of America is when they promote comics like the so-called CalExit comic, stating that there will be a heavily armed resistance force fighting U.S. troops and U.S. Law enforcement in the streets.
Well, Professor Pearl, could I ask you a question?
Yeah. Is
this comic book, this strange, violent cover on this comic book, does this have to do with the notion of what happened to the South when the war happened, that the federal government would not take nicely to to California seceding and yeah. therefore would send troops in, and this is a response to that? Is that what they're purporting?
I think that's heavily implied, explicitly. The Homeland Security forces here are, they've set upon the state of California now, I guess in the comic book, the occupied state of California, in order to exact draconian measures to export or send undocumented immigrants back to the states of their origination. And this sets off a tidal wave of protest, of counter U.S. sentiment, the kind that sparks a revolution. So they are tacitly getting at that same concept that the federal government will use violence to protect its sovereign border, and they are saying that they would meet this violence with force.
However, Professor Pearl, when you discuss the 10th Amendment, when you describe the 10th Amendment, does that not guarantee the state's ability if the state wants to secede?
Yeah. And again, it is interpreted very differently by different people. I would say perhaps, right? Others would say, well, you know, how can you justify the invasion of the Confederate States of America? And I don't know that I wouldn't hold a nation state morally responsible for trying to stop a reprehensible era like the slavery era in the pre-antebellum South. That being said, violence is clearly not the answer. But we do have substantive areas where there's a great disagreement between both California, the citizens of California, I should say, and the citizens of the other 49 states.
And I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I was thinking about the environmental principles that California also purports that the federal government is in contrast to. So, for example, Governor Brown has recently come out and said, okay, in terms of climate change, we're going to pick up the ball here. You know, we're going to do something about that. In fact, we're going to host conferences with this. We're going to do something about carbon tax with corporations. we're going to pass environmental regulations that protect the citizens, that protect the environment. And see, there's the criticism that somehow regulations are going to damage the economy. But as you said, Professor Pearl, that California has one of the largest economies in the world. It's larger than France, from what I read, in terms of the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. California wants to have, well, Governor Brown would like to see high-speed rail, you know, and in even other areas of, for example, health care. So we seem to be very different in terms of what we value versus other states, or many other states, not to say that there are some that wouldn't also embrace some of those principles.
Well, and I think even the numbers are more encouraging than that. We have a per capita income that far exceeds, I think the entire American South. So there is no state in the American South with a higher per capita income, parts of Texas withstanding, parts of Georgia withstanding as well. We are a very rich state per capita, and that includes all the folks that are coming in who are new citizens and contributing to the economy. Now, there's no way to gauge how undocumented folks fare in that mix. But you did mention climate change, and I think here too you're correct. I mean, we have a national government that seems hell bent on denying what we call anthropogenic global warming. In other words, man-made
yes.
Climate change, I should say, not global warming. And this includes the wide and wider variation in climate, in climate patterns, I should say. And our own governor has sought to engage in the kind of leadership that previous administrations at the national level have had. I definitely agree with that. There are other areas as well. You mentioned regulation in terms of consumer safety.
Yes.
California is, we have our own consumer, I forget the exact title of it, it's a Consumer Product Safety Commission that certainly exceeds the level of regulation on the national scale. We have, harder and more difficult certification for many of the trades for folks engaged in things like installing all manner of, electricians, for example. It's much more difficult to get a license here in the state of California than Nevada.
Could I also give another example, which it's just that in this last week, I was talking to a friend of mine from the college, as a matter of fact, and she had been in Montana, and the deck at her parents' place is 30 feet up above the ground. And she was concerned that her daughter might fall off. And I went, well, I don't quite understand that. I mean, the code says you have to have slats, wooden slats, every few inches, so that doesn't happen, that children don't fall, animals don't fall off. And she goes, Pamela, this is Montana. This is not California. And so I think it's really, really interesting in terms of what you're just saying here, the safety features and the regulations that are for the people, not for the companies, but for the people.
Yeah. Now, there's, obviously there needs to be some delicate balance where...
Yes.
Even as you notice, when you go to the gas pump and you pump the gas, it's sealed quite well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go to Montana or almost any other state that I've been in, that's not the case. And so the fumes come flooding out.
Yeah. And this is a marginal cost. I mean, what it costs to have that that rubber part, maybe an extra $10 per pump, $20 per pump. But these things add up. And they add up to, I think, what your friend in Montana was alluding to, a situation where safety might be compromised at the expense of earning a marginally larger amount of money. But consumer safety definitely has very different, has been received differently by the various different states, as has, other issues like immigration. We are a very, and I think appropriately, tolerant state here in California. We see the vast improvements to our both economic lives and cultural lives when we allow newcomers to settle here and earn the same kind of living that we earn and the same kind of standards that we hope that our children will emulate. And that's not true for the rest of the country.
It is simply not true. And as a matter of fact, I mean, I'm not even exactly sure what they mean by the right to work states, but a right to work might be, well, I want to work. I'll work for $2 an hour. I mean, so there's not that minimum wage. There's not obviously a living wage. So California does value some of these, in my mind, some of these really important principles.
It's interesting that you say the right to work states are states that have really negative laws affecting union organization.
Yes.
Here in California, we are not a right to work. It's a mislabeled label. But, you know, typically the argument goes like this. Well, if you have an influx in undocumented labor, the unit cost of labor will go down for those who own the means of production, and people that have union jobs will be pushed out of those union jobs. But if you're in a state like California, where union activity is protected, where the right to organize is protected, even amongst the undocumented, then you will avoid that pitfall. You can avoid that trap entirely. And this is borne out by organizations like Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers. And for those of you that aren't aware, in the 1980s, it was very difficult to fly crop dusters, these planes that would, you know, drop pesticides on crops at night. And so what many grape companies in particular did, because they needed these pesticides to fall on their products to avoid infestation with pests, as they would fly these crop dusters during the day, but not just during the day, during the time when many undocumented immigrants were out picking the grapes. And all, you know, exactly what you'd think would happen happened. People had negative health effects. Women that were pregnant had children born with birth defects. They had no insurance. They were already being underpaid, forced to live in effectively company barracks at an extremely high and inflated cost, barracks that sometimes lacked running water. And these very, very poor immigrant people, they organized into this group, the United Farm Workers, and they called for an end to the practice. They also called for a more living wage. And the owners of these fields, of course, denied them. And so what did they do? They didn't take up arms like the, you know, black-clad guerrilla movement that the Cal Exit comics suggest, but rather they appealed to the compassion of their fellow man. They started a boycott of table grapes and California grape products. Now, this boycott was what one economist called marginally effective, meaning it threw off great profitability by something like 4 to 6%. But this was far more than it would cost these companies to fly their planes overnight, their crop dusters, and, you know, dust the fields with these toxic pesticides when human beings weren't out picking the grapes. Now, you can make the case, and I think modern science has, that, you know, even picking grapes or picking any fruit the day after these pesticides are launched is problematic. But this was by far an egregious violation of their humanity, though not the law. And since then, California has adopted practices for our agricultural production that are, well, that differ from almost any state. These include regulations dealing with things like runoff from our, you know, burgeoning cattle production, things like the amount of water that can be used during times of drought. You get the idea.
I know when I was working as a printer, because I did work as a printer.
Yeah.
And what we had a really toxic substance that cleaned our presses.
Yeah.
Well, when I moved to California, we used an orange solution, and it smelled good, and no longer irritated the people, and that was required in California, but not in Washington State at the time.
Oh, I see.
And so there's an example right there.
Yep.
It made such a difference in the quality of life for the people that were working on the presses.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of a cleaner.
It was a safe way to do it.
Yeah.
And it actually was. What's kind of funny about it? It was actually more effective. It cleaned those presses better than the horrible chemicals that we were using in Washington State.
Yeah.
And I think people forget the hard-won battles that folks like Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers went through in order to just simply protect themselves, to pick the food that we consume.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if it's bad for them, I mean, it's bad for us, too.
Yeah.
I mean, grapes that have been...
you know, and we see a similar struggle today with the Service Employees International Union trying to organize fast food workers,
yes.
workers who
yes.
are probably the most exploited in the state of California right after those who work in our fields. And the SEIU, you know, is met with the same sort of... you know, demonization, you know, oh, you know, if you don't pay these people very minimum wage, then it's going to drive the cost of a hamburger or French fries up so high
so
that no one will
what?
Be able to afford it.
Yeah.
Well, right.
Well, something I don't know if you're aware of or not, but Ohio and certain other states have now made rulings statewide that cities within the state that have chosen to make the minimum wage higher are not allowed to do that. And so people that were actually making better wages as a result in their city, in those states, have lost that, and they're back to their $7.75 or whatever it
yeah.
was an hour.
Yeah.
And there's also, but I mean, economic analysts have shown that when you raise the minimum wage, you pay a decent you have a decent minimum wage. These people have more money, and I don't mean these people, but the people who
sure.
are doing those
sure.
jobs have more money in their pockets to put back into the economy.
Yeah.
And it is not a destructive thing to pay people a living wage.
Yeah. And it can go both ways, as you mentioned, Craig. And I mean, the best example, I think, is the current experiment occurring in King County in Washington, right, in the Seattle and the near Seattle area, where they've bumped the minimum wage up. I think by next year it will reach $15 mm-hmm. an hour, which
That's
is
great.
Still extremely low. I mean, this is not... you know, the life of a prince or princess. This is sort of just a wage necessary
but
to live.
You have to be careful because then the employers cut the hours and so on and so forth. And
yeah.
actually they are making like $125 less per month than they were before the minimum wage
right.
was bumped up.
Well,
right.
but it's not the employee's fault. It's the businesses themselves that refuse to incorporate this living wage within
sure.
their businesses.
And some can't.
Can.
But I think as time goes on, exactly the phenomenon that you described will occur. More money will be in circulation. More people will be out eating at their restaurant, and they'll be able to put people back to that 40-hour work week that is sustainable.
And
so that is the great hope. And I think that's where things are moving. The data is all over the place. We have a University of California study that says things are going quite well, and we have a study from one of the colleges in Boston, I forget at the time, that says things
yes.
are not going well in
yes.
Seattle. So there's alternate facts, as they say, in play.
And I wanted to mention one other thing. You know, in terms of fast food workers and or servers, that if they don't get sick leave, if they don't,
yeah.
they are forced to work, and they are serving your food, my food, and they're not well.
Yeah.
And this is not to our society's benefit. There are so many reasons to pay people a living wage and to have sick leave.
Mm-hmm.
So that people aren't on the job sick. And when flus and viruses are going around, and I was in one of the markets a few months ago, and they said, how are you? And I said, well, it was more than a few months ago, I was sick. And the person said, well, you know, half the people who work here have been sick or are sick now. And I'm
yeah.
thinking, everything that I pick up and touch and put, you know, bring to the conveyor belt,
yeah.
you know, I mean, people that are sick are...
All the better reason to wash everything. But at the same time, you want people to get well, right?
Yes,
because
yes,
when they go
course.
To...
You
I mean,
don't want them working.
Right.
When
I mean,
they're
the,
sick.
The effects compound
yes,
because these
yes.
are communicable
yes,
conditions,
yes.
you know, sickness of all types. So I would definitely, definitely agree.
Well, Professor Pearl, can I ask you another question?
You
what, and I don't know whether you wanted to speak to this now, but you did bring up immigration
yeah.
and how California is different from other states in this way, and that California has established in certain areas sanctuary cities. And from what I heard on the news in just the last couple of days is that two particular sanctuary cities in California are being threatened by the federal government in terms of, okay, you're not going to get this grant, we're going to pull this away. So I guess what I'm saying is that there are principles that I would support in terms of CalExit, and that, you know, the guiding principles of compassion, of cooperation, yeah, of treating people fairly, equally. I don't understand why we would want to do things, you know, differently than that.
Let me, I think I can answer that with a bit of a story.
Okay.
And first, I would never call these sanctuary cities. I think that's a little bit of a term that we've allowed those who are opponents to immigration to sort of set. These are cities that, you know, offer to take the moral stand,
yes,
against regulations that they view as inappropriate. And these are also not just inappropriate, but highly unproductive laws. Let's look at Texas. And again, a bit of a story. Texas has, in the last year, done away with what they called sanctuary cities, what I would not dub sanctuary cities. And exactly what you'd expect to happen has happened. The amount of immigration into those cities of undocumented workers hasn't changed one iota. What has changed is those undocumented workers are no longer confident enough to report crimes to the police for fear of deportation. This only helps organized crime in the state. It only helps those who prey on these immigrant populations. Because, you know, if I'm afraid that any call to a city official, to a police officer, to any member of any sort of state or federal body will result in the deportation of myself, my children, my family, I'm just going to ignore it. And when you look the other way, society begins to appreciably crumble. What Texas will find almost undeniably in the next decade is a epidemic of crime, particularly, though not necessarily, in committed by immigrants within these immigrant communities. Because what we know is that when you are unwilling to report crime, criminals take that as carte blanche to continue their activities. I'm going to quickly break for station identification, and then we'll return to talking about CalExit and indeed immigration. This is KKRN Community Radio, 88.5, Bella Vista, Round Mountain. We are volunteer supported. You are listening to Pearl on Politics. I am Professor David Pearl. We're discussing the so-called CalExit movement.
And Professor Pearl, do you mind if we take our half hour break right now,
just for
a few moments, and we'll be right back.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we, as we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming.
about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere. Will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let need not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense. It contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let need not greed lead the way. Let need not greed lead the way. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much and how much longer?
And hello and welcome back to Pearl on Politics. Professor Pearl, where would you like to take us now?
Well, I think we will finish our discussion on immigration and sort of the differences between California attitudes and national attitudes, and then talk about the pros and cons of the CalExit movement. Again, we have three people in our roundtable discussion, Pamela Spato, Craig Boyer, and myself. And we all have very different takes on this movement. So I think this would be a good exchange toward the end. But I did want to follow up because we've seen in the news the push by the White House for the so-called 2017 RISE Act. And this is an act that Republicans will be introducing in Congress, an act that the White House has heavily supported. This is an act that would limit the amount of green cards, these are the documents necessary for working and staying in the U.S., from 1 million per year down to 600,000 per year, and ultimately in 10 years, in a decade's time, down to 500,000. But they would also have rather stringent prerequisites for those coming into the states, one of which is a mandatory English language proficiency. And here is, again, where Californians tend to differ with our friends and neighbors in the other 49 states. We don't necessarily see a bilingual person as being disadvantaged, or somebody who knows a marginal amount of English, just enough to get by, and then is fluent in Spanish or fluent in French or in Russian or in Chinese. We don't see this as a necessary negative. There are portions of San Francisco, for example, where I can hear fluent Cantonese or Mandarin spoken. There are portions of Sacramento where Spanish is spoken. And it's not as if our society is crumbling and we have a degradation taking to our streets, quite the opposite. There was a commentator who mentioned that a person in East Los Angeles was complaining to the mayor at one of their, I forget what the forum is called, it's essentially a forum where the mayor would take questions. And this gal, she got up and she said, look, you know, my son could not get a job at a local McDonald's because he couldn't speak Spanish. And the mayor stopped for a second and he said, here in East Los Angeles, or in Los Angeles, I believe he said, or the person that answered. I don't know if it was the mayor. I'm not sure what the faces look like down in Los Angeles. But what they communicated to this person was that a person that knows English and Spanish has a tremendous advantage in the marketplace, that they can get a job at a restaurant quicker because they know these two languages, because they can serve people of all denominations that walk in. Now, you might say, well, this disadvantages our native population, but you could also use it as an opportunity to maybe expand your own level of education and learn another language. Now, I have never been fluent in two languages. I can speak a little bit of Spanish and even a smaller amount of German from my college days and high school days. But these are not factors that preclude us from interacting with each other. Rather, they increase the both the diversity and the ability of many to communicate who can't learn a second language. Now, the other portion of the RISE Act, and this is a portion that I definitely agree with, and I don't think anyone is against a background check for everyone coming into the country. I mean, no one is in their right mind would want somebody who, is wanted by the state of Honduras for a crime to be given, carte blanche to enter the United States. No one wants somebody who has ties to a group of religious fanatics to be allowed entry into the United States. Rather, they should be detained and sent back to where they are, could be prosecuted by the law if they're wanted. But we shouldn't limit the amount of people who could be qualified because it creates a perverse economic incentive to cheat the process entirely. And when you have, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people per year who would be otherwise qualified to enter the United States but cannot because of these artificial quotas, then what you have is what we have now. Undocumented people who live in the shadows, who fear calling law enforcement, who are afraid of interacting with the broader society for fear of being deported along with their children, their family, their immediate family, and their friends in some cases, back to their country of origin. This is an analogy, it's not a statistic, it has no merit, but my own family immigrated over 100 years ago from various parts of Eastern Europe and what is now considered Belarus, what was it then then considered part of the Russian Empire. And, this was a time when the limitations were, there were marginal quotas. They were completely unenforced. When you came into the country, there was no way to check your background because the records from these foreign countries were sparse at best. But today, there's no excuse not to include everyone that wants to come. We can find records from even automated computerized records from such obscure and backwards places as Afghanistan, for God's sake. So the idea that you need a quota because we can never be fully sure as to who's coming in, I think, is just a naked excuse to discriminate against people who don't sound or look like us.
I think that that's totally true. And in my opinion, there's so much fear-mongering going on. And it's hard for some people to separate fact from fiction when you have a president saying, all those people from Mexico are rapists and murderers. Yeah, yeah. I mean, my goodness, what kind of fear-mongering is that? So you're dismissing a whole group of people.
But remember that he did say, I believe some are good people, at the end of that sentence.
Oh,
so
some are good
caveat.
People?
I think,
right.
I suppose.
Right.
I think qualified that with, I suppose, I think.
He did? Yeah. So you get the idea of where he's coming from. Now,
yes.
I think that might have been playing to a Republican base that might have an interest in sort of an ethnic bias, perhaps. But it did win him the nomination. And this was a very difficult field for somebody with his background to win.
And his parents and grandparents also came from other countries. Germany was, did they not? And yeah. Did not speak English when they first came. So it's very, very curious that this RISE Act is saying you have to be proficient in English.
Yeah.
And that is going to be one qualification.
What's good
for that.
Good for the goose is seldom good for the gander. In this case, not at all.
It's interesting because his grandfather was not wanted in this country, and he begged to stay, and they didn't allow he wanted to go back to Germany, to Bavaria, and they didn't want to take him back.
Yeah.
And so he wound up having to stay in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's interesting, about half of the, about 40-something percent, they say, of the immigrants that came prior to 1940, but after the Civil War, actually did return to their home country or to other areas on the map, typically to portions of South America and or Canada. So this idea that, you know, this will be the ultimate and penultimate location for people to settle, I don't think bears, in line with the facts. And what I mean by that is if you are a person immigrating from Europe or Asia or Africa or even South America, and you come to America and you find, you know, hardship and you find perhaps even discrimination, as many do, and, you know, you can observe, you know, maybe a better working conditions, the idea that you can get a job and get legal status in a place like Canada quite a bit more easily. You know, who's to say that person wouldn't, you know, take the trip to our neighbors to the north? I don't think that this idea that people are necessarily flooding into the United States simply to settle here permanently bears out with the facts. People do all kinds of movements.
Well, can I ask you a question, Professor Pearl?
Yeah.
And this may be not exactly on target, but this is what one thing that drives me mad these days, and that is when the United States bombs countries' infrastructures, and there is no power, there's little sanitation, there's no law enforcement, and we can see this in Afghanistan, we can see it in Iraq, we can see it in Syria, we can see it in Libya, and Yemen, people, hundreds of thousands of people dying of cholera from weapons that we support Saudi Arabia with.
Yeah.
So these people are struggling to go somewhere safe. There's so many immigrants. My question is, do people, Americans, do people in the United States realize that our, in my opinion, our foreign policy is creating such dire situations that people have to flee? And then there's the economic sanctions that also create situations people flee.
I think our population does not, because we are so far removed from these places. But the populations of Europe are beginning to wake up to that fact, and for all the wrong reasons as well. You know, there's a flood of immigrants entering into Europe from North Africa and the Middle East.
Yes.
And this is to be expected when, I mean, if you don't want a flood of immigrants, don't bomb their countries into the Stone Age.
I view that we've opened up the gates of hell.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
We invaded Iraq and our time in Afghanistan. Yeah. And in messing around with Libya, we've opened up the gates of hell.
We've allowed organizations, I mean, speaking of this hell analogy, organizations as deplorable, even to the local populations, as the Islamic State.
Yes.
To be viewed as effectively liberators. This is just bizarre in my mind. But when you look at the fact that what has the West provided the Arab world other than, or the Muslim world, the world of North Africa and Libya, other than death and destruction, I think the hell analogy is apt. Now, people in Europe, upon this wave of immigration, exactly what you'd expect to happen did happen. Amongst any population, you're going to have roughly 1 to 6%, you know, scufflaws, people who engage in horrible behavior. Every instance of rape, every instance of criminal looting, every instance of poor behavior by a single immigrant is blamed on the entire population.
Yes.
And these, particularly in Northern Europe, where these immigrants want to go and settle because they are typically the states with the most job opportunities, et cetera, the populations have grown, have moved from their state of sort of acceptance of other cultures to a state akin to xenophobia. And I think that a lot of this has to do with the fact that the minority of these immigrants are being labeled by the actions of a slim minority. I turn to, you know, YouTube. If you type in European immigration, the first five videos that'll come up will be either, you know, somebody with brown skin looting, some charge of gang rape, some horrible crime. But this does not represent the entirety of a people. I mean, if I was to be blamed for the actions of, you know, every single Caucasian that has, you know, committed a crime in the last 10 years, I would be considered a reprobate, a horrible human being. We must not, I think, fall into the pitfall of blaming the actions of the one on the many. Again, I think this is a good segue into the differences between the attitudes in the state of California and those in the rest of the country, because we do not, blame the criminal actions of the minority on the majority of immigrants who are hardworking, that want exactly what we want from life. You know, a good job, decent schools, a great place to live, a future for themselves and their children.
And I think that is so important, what you just said. I mean, people wouldn't be immigrating if they felt secure in their own countries. Yeah. I mean, because I believe, just as you said, we all want similar kinds of things. Human beings are human beings.
Yeah. Now, so, I mean, and there's a caveat there, because we have these two categories, right? We have economic migrants, and we have folks looking for asylum.
Yes.
Clearly in the Muslim world, where if you are a Yazidi woman in northern Syria, you have every right to believe that if you return to northern Syria, you may be effectively enslaved by the Islamic State or by one of these U.S.-supported jihadi groups. There, the case for this is not an economic migrant, I should say, but somebody seeking asylum, political asylum. They fear for their life. They fear from what the UN calls persecution. And we have a legal responsibility to these folks. We have a moral responsibility to economic migrants, meaning if they can find a job in the market, if they, you know, can follow our laws, then they should be welcomed in the same way as any of us in this room should be welcomed into the marketplace. And this is, again, where conservatives play this little semantic game. They say, well, by definition, they are violating our laws because they are here illegally, right? They even go so far as to call these human beings illegals, which is another pejorative I wouldn't use. But they state that they have necessarily broken the law. And that is true, which is why we need to move these artificial quotas to something that we can manage based on how many background checks we can process. And this is where, again, the cities that the Republican right has labeled as sanctuary cities that have told the federal government that if they encounter an undocumented person, they are not going to report them to immigration. Yes. This is where there's a marked difference between California cities, cities like San Francisco and Sacramento and Los Angeles, and cities in the Midwest, in the Northeast, in the American South. This marked difference is in other areas as well. I think we'll sort of wrap up the program talking about the benefits and costs associated with a California exit. Now, for me, you know, I can see the benefits to an exit from California. We all have very different opinions on this topic, and we'll talk to each of us in turn. But it seems to me that if enough Californians decide they want to leave the United States through popular referendum, the 10th Amendment would allow them to do so, but only peacefully. I mean, up until that point, we are all Americans, and even afterwards, we would want to continue trade with our friends in the United States as well. This should not be seen as a violent secession, and those who promote it, like the Yes California campaign, who heavily publicized the comic book that I'm looking at right now, I think should be very much ashamed of themselves. Now, there are other groups, the California Freedom Party, for example, that have similar views as my own. And retiring, you know, I think that one of their commentators said that it will be his pleasure to see the California flag be the only flag that is raised above our state house, but that he would treat the American flag with all the respect and dignity that it deserves. And it's that kind of hope and purpose that I think can persuade people not only here in California, but also in the other 49 states to leave now, or to allow California to invoke the 10th Amendment and leave. Now, there's some negatives to this as well. I mean, what will happen to the other 49 states? Well, California has 55 electoral.
They've become very Republican.
Well, very much so, right? I mean, California has 55 electoral college votes. And those 55 votes are a Goliath in presidential politics, right? It would move the other 49 states very much further to the right. But the counter argument to that is, even with California's 55 votes, the country's moved extremely far to the right. We have a judiciary controlled by Republican nominees. We have a legislative branch controlled by the Republicans. We have a executive branch dominated by one party, the Republican Party, as well. So I'm not sure that California and its mighty 55 electoral college votes leaving the union would necessarily change the politics, though it would make it very, very difficult in the future for someone from the left, broadly speaking, to get elected. Though, if we look at those who have been nominated to, run for election at the national level on the Democratic side, they are not folks that share California values. I mean, California was decisively, I think, with if you ignore for the massive media campaign and the funny business that the Clinton campaign engaged in, we would have solidly gone for Bernie Sanders in the primary. Except for a few districts, I think that's true. But we share very, very different values, not only from our friends and neighbors that are Republicans, but from our friends and neighbors that are members of the Democratic Party. So why don't we, Craig, we'll start with you. And I know you've given some thought to this as to, why you might, not support in this case, the CalExit movement. I was wondering if you could touch on that, and then we'll talk
okay,
about it some
I'll,
more.
Okay, I'll do it so as I've written it out here,
sure.
Because it makes some sense. Okay, I'm not for the California exit. I'm not vehemently against it either. Now, my main reason is that I feel uncomfortable with the coming apart of people and their governments, and I believe that we would benefit by unifying more and not less. And I believe that ultimately, if we are to survive as a species, I suspect that it will require one world government, and exiting the United States seemed to be going in the opposite direction. Now, perhaps such splitting apart is required right now, but it doesn't feel right to me. Hmm. I could be persuaded that CalExit is the right thing to do, but I suspect I would not be an avid supporter of such a move. On a different example of exiting yet another government, I've come to believe that we should not have exited Great Britain in the first place and should have followed the example of Canada. Hmm. Our killing and our dying in that effort was successful in creating yet another imperial power, unlike Canada. Still, I kind of fancy the path Canada took and prefer their form of government. In summation, I tend to believe that further fragmentation is not the way to go, and we should learn to work together.
Yeah, and there's a lot to that. And we see a lot of historical examples where the breakup of a society has led to absolute ruin. I mean, we could look, even in our own lifetime, back to the fall of the Soviet Union. And for those of you that are younger members of the audience, the world of 1988 was very different than the world of 1991. Everyone believed that the Soviet Union, the monolith that was the communist empire that Russia had carved out for itself after World War II, after the revolution in 1919, in fact, would never collapse. And then one day it did. We are a state in the United States until we aren't, in the same way as Belarus or Ukraine or Georgia or anywhere else was a part of the Soviet Union, what we call a Soviet Socialist Republic, until they weren't. And what you alluded to is correct. The Soviet collapse was catastrophic. It led to ethnic tension. It led to sectarian and ideological tension between groups that were not often nonviolent. That being said, what came out of the end of this of the Soviet period might have been catastrophic economically for the Soviet people, even more than socially. Wages went way down. Associate of mine, who I won't name, told me that his salary at a university in Moscow went down to effectively $100 a month, meaning he made just about as much money selling fruit and vegetable from his family's dacha, which is like their little country home, on the side of the road as he did from his university stipend. And I don't think that would happen in California. Our economy in California is in the $2 trillion a year range. The economy of the entire Soviet Union was in the $500 to $800 million range. We have the ability, I think, here to avoid that economic collapse. Now, the question is, do we have the moral authority to leave? Will it cost lives? And if it costs lives, I agree with you, in the same way as Canada. They didn't have the same tradition of violent struggle as we did here.
It turned out rather well. for Canada.
It did. Except, well, I mean, some Canadians, the indigenous population didn't turn out well,
well
anywhere.
No,
right?
I do agree with that.
If we're looking at legitimacy, we're talking about something very different. Pamela, we only have about 5 minutes to go. Why don't you want to
and
talk
And I'm going
about
to take
Palin's
them all. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Yes. I think that I am more in favor of Cal exit than I am not.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it would be nice if what Craig is purporting could happen. It's like the working together. And as I watch Congress on the federal level, and it used to be that, I guess, as they say, people on either side of the aisle could talk to each other. And now it's like one party wants to destroy the other party. I'm sick of that. You know, you want to do
me
that?
Too.
Okay. My attitude is, you want to do that? Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be in California. I want a progressive agenda. I want certain principles and values to be followed. And I totally agree with you, Dr. Pearl, in terms of we have moved to the right, but not by accident. And you probably would agree with that, too. I mean, there has been think tanks, conservative think tanks that have thought up many, many different ways of moving us to the right. And there's corporate media. A lot of people get their information from corporate media. Education has become big business in many different kinds of ways. And so there's this move to the right, and it's almost monolithic when I think about the military, you know, in terms of can we do anything about this huge, bloated military that takes away from the people, things that the people would like to have.
Yeah.
Like, and this is where I think California could step in and be a model, could be a leader in terms of environmental protection, single-payer health care, education that believes in science, that we're pro-science, pro-intellectual development, that because we could become wiser citizens, you know, rather than the consumer. I really resent being looked at as a population of consumers. I am a citizen.
Mm.
And that we believe in climate change, well, except for Lamalfa, our representative. And it's really interesting, the billboards, he is one of us. You know, that's
I think the language there, you've fallen trap. Beliefs is not the word, because we are simply looking at evidence. We're not in any belief system. This isn't superstition.
Right.
This is looking at the science. So I would agree with that, but caveat there.
Yes, yes. And our governor, in many ways, has done positive things. I mean, there are certain things he's allowed fracking within the state, and which I'm totally opposed to. And that some people believe that with his climate change initiative now, he's given away too much to corporations. But still, we're moving in the direction that climate change is real. We're teaching it in schools.
Mm-hmm.
There's what I call social justice issues in terms of how we treat people of color, the LGBT Q community, criminal justice and drug reform, and even like marijuana in terms of legalization of marijuana and consumer safety. So I'm thinking that there are so many good things that California represents.
Yeah.
And I would like to see the whole West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, and the East Coast. I mean, there must be some states on the East Coast that would agree with some of these principles. So it wouldn't just be California. So those are some of the reasons why I would... I think California should lead the way and not give all of our billions of dollars of tax money to the federal government for the military-industrial complex.
I would agree with that as well.
Complex.
Now, just in terms of the tax disparity, we spend about $11 to $14 billion a year more than we receive from the federal government, meaning we are effectively subsidizing Alabama, Mississippi, you know, all of the southern states that have a very different view of collecting taxation than we do.
Yes.
Look, let's be realistic. We are a state, as you said, I probably wouldn't use the word social justice. I'd call it a state that promotes equity because we've always treated citizens, regardless of color, class, or ascribed status, with the same legal respect. We haven't always treated people with the same respect socially. So I'd remove that the sort of social justice contingent. In fact, even today, you can find plenty of Californians who exhibit, you know, the kind of biases that none of us want to see. But that being said, the economic disparity is tremendous. Well, the hour is coming to a close, and I wanted to, before we leave, mention to everyone that you can view this program on kkrn.org, our website, or on the radio at, I believe it's 9 a.m.,
at 9 a.m. Saturday morning.
Thank you very much. This has been Dr. David Pearl with Pamela Spato and Craig Boyer in the studio. Have a good one.
And thank you. And see you next time. Oh, and just so the audience knows, next Saturday will be Craig Boyer with Music with a Message. So please tune in. Goodbye for now.